Welcome to today's edition of the Rush Limbaugh Show podcast.
The American people always get it right in the end. They do. It's a fact. And you may be concerned about the election results back from 2020, but the votes that really, really, really matter are the census numbers we're seeing unfold. And there are no progressives who are happy, no liberals who are happy with these Census Bureau numbers that have come out in the last 24 hours. Welcome to the program. I am thrilled to be here today as your guide host from beautiful Charlotte in the Queen City. Our telephone number, as always, here on the Rush Limbaugh Show is 800-282-2882, 800-282-2882, and be sure to check out rushlimbaugh.com. Here's the key takeaway, and you've been watching the coverage of this across the last 24, 36 hours as this information has been moving out from the Census Bureau, the census reporting, and the implications for the states. Six states stand to gain House seats. Seven states are going to lose seats. This is a big deal because, as Rush said so many times behind this golden EIB microphone, the American people live as conservatives. The American people are a conservative people. Even if you vote Democrat, at your core level, if you go down on the issues, you're a conservative person by and large. That group of Bernie Sanders, AOC, super leftist California and New York coastal liberals is not a huge number. It's really not. They occupy large states. They control large states. But they are not in the majority. California and New York are among the states likely to lose House seats in census data. Florida and Texas are set to gain. That's the reporting out of Fox. The Minneapolis Star Tribune notes that Minnesota won't lose 8th congressional seat, Census Bureau rules. Boy, that's a practical victory, isn't it? California's going to lose a congressional seat. I'll give you a great analysis on that coming up. But when you look at the states that are now adding, that are now the winners, Texas, Florida, Colorado, Montana, and North Carolina, along with Oregon, but not the Portland part of Oregon, the regular part of Oregon. They are the winners. They're going to be adding seats. The losers, California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. Now, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and I know Mike DeWine is the governor in Ohio, but let's be honest, these are states that are held hostage, along with California, by a huge pension system, by an out-of-control bureaucracy. These are states that, by and large, embraced full lockdowns. West Virginia has been experiencing a decades-long exodus of residents, and that has caused them to lose a congressional seat, which is tricky because their congressional seats are, I believe it's three Republicans. It'll become two Republicans. But Rush knew this. He predicted this. He talked about all of this. And in fact, what do you say we go back to when Rush Limbaugh talked about one particularly high-profile departure from the state of New York to Florida, President Trump?
So I heard, like everybody else did, the tweet from President Trump last night that he was leaving New York, that he was making it official. He was going to relocate and establish, for in fact, already done it, his residence will be right here in Palm Beach. And so the speculation began. He was very open about why. He said, look, I don't like the way I'm being treated here. You know, the people in New York, everybody that's ripping him used to beg him for money, used to come by seeking his endorsement, wanted to be on his TV shows. And then he came out as a Republican and all of that ended. I was playing golf with Trump at his golf course back in the, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. And he's asking me, why did you leave? Why did you really leave New York? Because, you know, Rush, I'm hearing more and more people saying they got to get out. And I told him exactly what I told you. He said, it's incredible. Why would they hassle you like that? They're not hassling me. They don't like losing the money. They can't stand losing the money. And they're just trying to get as much of it as they can even after you leave. He said, well, I'm thinking about it, but I don't know how I can. Everything I have in New York is New York. Everything I do, I don't know how I can leave, but I know more and more people talking about it. And this is 10, 15 years ago. So now there is an exodus, and it's not just from New York. It's from other high-tax states. And don't forget now with Trump's tax reform, the state local tax deduction limitation, state taxes are now much higher for people in these high-tax blue states. And look at what they're getting for it. I mean, the cities, in large part, are cesspools. And the income gap, the divide between haves and have-nots, middle-class rich, middle-class poor, is widening. I mean, everywhere you look, the evidence of out-of-control liberalism, unchecked liberalism, is creating misery and disaster. And when people do have the ability to flee it, they do. The problem, as you know, is that when liberals flee, they take all the crap they believe with them to wherever their new location is, and they start corrupting that place. They start polluting that place with their liberalism. So liberalism travels. So I understand the president leaving. And, of course, when I left, New York State authorities were mean and vicious and mocking. Grab audio soundbite number two. In fact, I left New York in 1997, but in 2009, in an effort to beat these endless audits, I sold a condo. I had a condo there, which I loved. I announced starting in 2009, I'm selling that condo and I am never doing another day's work in New York. Because the deal I have with New York tax authority is that I owe them a minimum flat amount. And you wouldn't believe how much this is. If I show up and do this radio program in New York for 3 hours one day, I owe them more money than the average mean national income in this country is. So I don't go. It's not the money. It's the principle of the thing. And that was 2009 when I sold the condo, because selling the condo, I thought, this will convince them. I got no place to stay there. Didn't work. You could be hiding out in a hotel under assumed name, they said. Anyway, here's my announcement, March 30th, 2009.
I told Mayor Bloomberg, I'll be the first to lead the way. You know, this is just, I'll sell my apartment, I'll sell my condominium, I'm going to get out of there totally. Because this is just absurd, and it's ridiculous, and it isn't going to work. It's punishing the achievers for the mistakes and the lack of discipline on the part of a bunch of corrupt politicians that have run that city and state into the ground for I don't know how many years. And I, for one, am not going to take the blame for it.
Okay, so when I made the announcement official, see, the fact that I had moved beginning in 1997 was kind of under the radar. I didn't make a big deal about it. But I did when I announced selling the condo and getting out of it. And here's the governor at the time, David Patterson, held a press conference.
If I knew that would be the result, I would have thought about the taxes earlier.
If we could have gotten rid of Limbaugh sooner, I would have raised taxes sooner. Well, this is what Governor Cuomo, when Trump announces that he's leaving, good riddance. It's not like Mr. Trump paid taxes here anyway. He's all yours, Florida. See, that's all you are to them. You're just taxpayers. To liberal politicians, that's all you are. You're taxpayers and your voters. Every 2 or 4 years, that's all that you matter to them. So just want to let you know, folks, my name's not any of these stories, but I was the beginning of the exodus.
And you listen to what Rush just said there. You're just taxpayers. To liberal politicians, that's all you are. You're taxpayers and your votes. For every 2 or 4 years, that's all that you matter to them. That's it. That's the sum total of your value. And so as a consequence, what have we seen take place over the last decade, right? Because you get the census every 10 years. But just in the last year during the COVID lockdowns, you saw people saying, you know what? I got to get out. I got to get out of New York. I got to get out of Illinois. I got to get out of New Jersey. I've got to get out of Michigan and Ohio. I've got to get out of California. I was one of those people. I personally was one of those people who fled Southern California. I was south of Southern California to Charlotte, to the Carolinas. And what I notice being here is that the governance, it's not perfect. Government is a pain everywhere. But at least they're not actively trying to destroy you on a daily basis. Well, save the lockdown types like Governor Roy Cooper in North Carolina. But they're not actively attempting to destroy you and preventing you from keeping money that you have earned. The wrong lesson is going to be learned off of this, by the way. The absolute wrong lesson. The lesson will be, you see, we need to get more aggressive in collecting tax dollars, like David Patterson alluded to in the Rush clip, saying, oh, if I'd known that raising the taxes could have gotten rid of him sooner, I would have done it. Right now, Andrew Cuomo, the state of New York, they're sitting there looking at this brand new tax bill that they've put out there to really soak the rich, to really take the rich people down and the middle class people down and to show them who's boss. That's the lesson that's going to be mislearned. It's going to be the wrong lesson, and they're going to continue to raise taxes. It's just like whenever you see a national election go badly for the Democrats, they think their message didn't get out. No, the message got out perfectly fine. It was rejected. High taxes, regulation, dangerous streets, schools you don't want to send your kids to, places you don't want to spend any time in because they are lawless. Those are the reasons why people leave. Those are the reasons why people leave. And the American people got it right. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. It is the Rush Limbaugh Show. I am Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. The reality is what we're seeing from these blue states and these blue cities inside these blue states, or blue cities inside of red states, is we're seeing that liberals are just sad. They're sad. They want desperately to have this utopian vision of everybody just living happily and getting along and all that sort of stuff. They want that to work out desperately. But the reality is, these high tax cities, they've been created by the liberals. And as Rush pointed out just a couple of years ago, liberals are the ones fleeing the high tax cities that they actually created.
More than 41% of New Yorkers say they can't afford to live in the city, and they plan to leave. And then there is an accompanying list of the fastest shrinking cities in the country. And you know what's happening here? A bunch of people are fleeing cities that they have participated in creating. The political circumstances. They voted for a bunch of libs who've raised taxes and choked off economic growth. They've raised real estate prices, and now they think they got to leave. And they leave. And they go to other states, presumably no income tax states, and they bring with them the same destructive political ideas, and they start electing the same people that destroyed the places that they're leaving. 41% say they can't afford to live in New York City and plan to leave. It's probably not that high that'll actually move out of there, but what if it was?
What if it was? Think about the constraints of living in New York. I've lived in New York. I've lived in the West Coast. I now live, as I mentioned earlier, in the Carolinas. Here's the reality of things. You have incredible confiscatory tax rates. You have difficulty when it comes to starting a business, maintaining a business because of the insane regulation that's been put into place. When there are opportunities for economic growth, you have Congress members like AOC sinking the Amazon 2 headquarters that was going to go in Long Island City. That wasn't just going to create the jobs for the people that worked at Amazon, but was going to create 50,000 jobs in an ancillary way. And she comes in and says, well, no, that's not a good company. That's not a good job. We don't want that. And then presto change-o, what happens? The coronavirus, the COVID crisis comes through. And now suddenly you have millions of people who have been sent to work from home. The remote workers. Some of the folks are described as, according to thestreet.com, digital nomads. These are people who say, you know what? There goes a group of people leaving New York City for greener pastures. Now I can leave New York City for greener pastures, work from my home out in a rural part of New Jersey or Connecticut or Pennsylvania or even into South Carolina or Georgia. I can relocate and continue to do the job. I don't have to deal with the insanity of mis, mal, and nonfeasance on the streets of New York, where you see crime at an epidemic rate. You have the wholesale subsidization of lunatic policies brought to you by Comrade Bill de Blasio and the governor, Andrew Cuomo. You see these people taking great joy at the notion of being liberated and still being able to collect that salary. If I'm making New York money, but I'm doing the job, I'm doing the job out in a rural part of Virginia, I've got it made. I've got it made. These cities are amazing things. New York in its prime, New York in the time of Rudy Giuliani as mayor was an incredible place to live. I know because I was there at that time. It was an incredible place to live. That city was exploding with opportunity. Why? Because you had policing. You had people keeping public safety a top issue. You had a mayor who was interested in bringing business in. You had a fundamental transformation of Times Square. What was once upon a time a hotbed of porno theaters and derelicts became a crown jewel that the world flocked to be a part of. And even in the wake of the September 11th attacks, even in the wake of that, the city came back strong. It wasn't until you ended up with full-blown socialism taking over that city and a decision to say we're going to normalize criminality. We're going to subsidize criminality. We're not going to arrest perpetrators who go out and commit minor crime, serious crime, any crime. That's when it began to spin out of control. You compound that with the coronavirus pandemic, the hopelessness, and the exodus from the city out to brighter pastures, and it's really very sad to see that city in decay, but it's the same story in city after city. It was just a few weeks ago we talked about Lady Gaga's dog walker getting shot walking her dogs in a nice part of West Hollywood in Los Angeles, a place with $2 million mansions, $3 million mansions, $5 million mansions. The police have been made the enemy. Criminals have been the recipients of excuse making, and politicians stand there and say the answer is more taxation, more regulation, and less law enforcement. So why do people leave these glittering cities? Why do they head out to a place that's got greater opportunity, a better quality of life, better schools, a functioning government, the ability to buy a home and live in a home in a beautiful neighborhood for what it costs for a one-bedroom apartment in one of these big cities? Oh, I don't know. What would motivate them to do that? What would drive them to do that? Quality of life's an important thing. Think about any job you've ever taken. One of the main concerns was how much you were going to get paid and what was your quality of life going to be. That's a universal sentiment. When people were presented with the opportunity to flee, they fled. Now there's a challenge to make sure they don't bring with them their big government, socialistic, ever-expanding taxing and regulating norms that they had in these blue states, these blue cities. There's a reason people left New York. They didn't want to bring the people that they are moving toward, don't want them bringing those New York City habits into their communities. Money will flow to the place it's respected. Money is mobile. Up next, we'll talk about policing. I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today, the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. And thank you. It is wonderful to be here today. In moments, we're going to jump into this policing in America issue. We're starting to see creep coming into the world of policing from the federal government in a way that, well, honestly, we've seen it before, and Rush is going to tell you about that in just moments. But first, let me grab a call from Bill in Windsor, New York, first up on the program. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, Brent. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
You're doing a great job. You can't fill Rush's shoes, obviously. He was one of the greatest patriots this country ever had.
Amen.
And what you were just talking about, I was talking with your producer earlier, we are literally fleeing upstate New York. Mm-hmm. We've lived here all our lives. We love the area. Mm-hmm. And about 3 years ago or 4 years ago, The governor told us we didn't belong in his state because we were pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, mm-hmm. pro-traditional marriage. My wife and I are in our early 60s. We're not quite ready to retire, and we feel compelled now. We just sold our house. We've got a contract on it with heavy hearts, but we are looking into another state, a southern state, a red state, to get out of this area.
If I may ask you, what line of work are you in?
I work in healthcare, physical healthcare. Therapy.
So you're somebody who is a skilled practitioner, providing a service to the residents, doing your best work, and you love where you are, but you're being driven out by the political class in Albany that is telling you that you are not welcome, you are not wanted, and as far as they're concerned, just leave your tax dollars there on the table and we'll collect it.
That's exactly right, yeah. And we're very afraid of. We have chosen, my wife and I have chosen at this time not to get this vaccine mm-hmm. because of the FDA's non-approval as of this point. Uh-huh. And we can see what's coming down the line with these passports. And I think ultimately they're going to try to do what they do, black against white, gay against straight, and they're going to try to get vaxxers against non-vaxxers. Yeah. And we don't want to be pariah, and we don't want to be Nazi Germany. Yeah.
I understand that, and I appreciate you sharing your story because it's illustrative of so many millions of other people who have already moved and are looking to move, Bill. I appreciate you being out there. All the best to you and your wife, and good luck. The fact of the matter is, as we look at this situation that's unfolding, you're seeing the most productive people driven from the states that are in most need of their tax dollars, and those states just want to keep ramping it up. In addition, the public safety issue is paramount. Nobody wants to live in a dangerous community, in a dangerous neighborhood. And the key to keeping the streets safe is at least a modicum of respect for those who are charged with protecting us in our cities, in our towns, in our states. The police are a vitally important group of people. They are right now in the spotlight like never before. For what it is that they're doing. And they understand that at some point this is a losing proposition for them. Right now, retirements are up 75% in New York City. And you know what else is up? Crime. Well, enter Merrick Garland. Merrick Garland is the Attorney General of the United States. And the Biden Justice Department under Merrick Garland are bringing in the efforts to start investigating the Minneapolis police. In fact, Attorney General Merrick Garland on Monday announced an investigation into the policing practices of the Louisville Police Department. That's the Breonna Taylor case that was centered on. The investigation will assess whether the Louisville Metro Police Department engages in a pattern or practice of using unreasonable force, including with respect to people involved in peaceful, expressive activities, says Merrick Garland. What does this mean? Well, it means it's going to be round number 2 or 3 or 5 of the federal police decrees that we saw once upon a time coming from the Obama administration. Rush talked about this.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions has ordered Justice Department officials to review all of these consent decrees and reform agreements with troubled police forces nationwide, saying it was necessary to ensure that these consent decrees do not work against the Trump administration's goals of promoting police officer safety and morale while fighting violent crime. Consent decree is one of these terms of legality that many people might not understand. But here's essentially what it is. Necessarily require this. In fact, there were 14 consent decrees between the Obama Justice Department and local police departments. Let's focus on Ferguson, Missouri, since everybody knows that. After Ferguson blew up and this hands up, don't shoot thing happened, the Obama Justice Department took advantage of the opportunity to essentially take over that police department by accusing it of harboring racists and behaving in a racist manner in terms of law enforcement. And since every city and every town gets federal money for this or that, the Obama DOJ held them up and said, if you want to continue getting federal money, you've got to sign this consent decree.
which essentially allowed the Department of Justice to proclaim that a police department was racist or practicing racism and to implement corrective measures that would be overseen by the Department of Justice. In this way, the Obama DOJ took over local police departments for, I believe, the express purpose to limit local law enforcement in pursuing criminal actions of minorities. And if you want me to back that up, I will. I hope you don't need me to waste time. All I could point out to you is Eric Holder refusing to prosecute the new Black Panthers in Philadelphia for vote fraud and tampering because he said, I'm not going to go after my people or some such thing. Not in this administration. It was early on, 2009. They did this in Baltimore. They did it in a number of places. The point of this story is that Sessions is now reviewing all these consent decrees. And if they find these consent decrees from the Obama DOJ to local police departments are actually hamstringing local law enforcement from doing their jobs, they're going to change it. It's just another bit of evidence that the Trump administration is draining the swamp, that the Trump administration is doing what it swore it would do, doing what it promised it would do. It is continuing to unravel as much of the extra-constitutional, extra-judicial behavior of the Obama administration. I also have no doubt that the Obama administration, his consent decrees taking over police departments, let's look at how many of them are in sanctuary cities. And I'll bet we might be surprised.
Now, that's a very important point that Rush raises at the end. The idea that these sanctuary city police departments and the taking over with the consent decrees, that was a huge issue. And what happened when you heard the call by President Trump once upon a time, and of course Sessions and then into Bill Barr, looking to hold sanctuary cities accountable for cooperating with federal authorities when it came to ICE operations, right? Remember Libby Schaff out in Oakland? She refused. In fact, she went on TV and warned people who were undocumented to get out of town because the raids are coming, all that sort of stuff. You have a situation here where when the Trump administration tried to say to these communities, since you're breaking the law by being sanctuary jurisdictions, we don't want to give you money, those people immediately ran to court. So essentially what you have in the case of Merrick Garland with Louisville and Minneapolis, and I'm certain we can go across the spectrum, they'll go to Columbus next, they will go to Elizabeth City, they'll go to all of these different communities, and they're going to come in and say, you must sign off on this consent decree because the federal government knows better about policing in your community than you know. And what will be the practical effect of this? I'm willing to predict this. You're going to see another outflow of men and women in law enforcement saying, this is another impediment to us doing our jobs. The fact that we have to Merrick May I, to Attorney General Garland, Merrick, may I enforce the law? Merrick, may I make an arrest? Merrick, may I do this or do that? And it's just another barrier to wanting to patrol and to safely serve the people of these communities. Again, you've heard it time and time again. No police officer puts on that badge and goes out onto the streets and intends to hurt or kill anybody. Their number one objective is public safety and to get home at night. That's what it comes down to. The bad guys have to be run from the job, but we cannot look at this through a mass punishment decree. Up next, we've got something incredibly special. You're going to want to hear about this. You're going to love it. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. One of the great privileges that I've ever had in working with Rush was getting to know this incredible team that has done such incredible things for the 32 years of the program of the Rush Limbaugh Show. Working with Rush was the highlight of my professional life in terms of the time I got to spend with him, to talk to him, to see how he thought, to see how he worked, to see how he worked through different sorts of issues, stories, challenges even, right? I mean, the man was truly resilient. Well, look, there is something new coming out that you need to know about, and I think you're going to absolutely love it. We're looking forward to listening to a new podcast series debuting in just 2 weeks' time. It's hosted by our own James Golden, often referred to by Rush as Snerdly. Here's the voice that you're going to get to hear each week with a new episode.
Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. It's a new podcast hosted by yours truly, James Golden, or, as many of you know me, Bo Snerdly. I'm going to take you behind the scenes for an intimate look at the man, Rush Limbaugh, who changed America as we know it. It's coming May 12th to iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, presented by the Tunnel to Towers Foundation and MyPillow.
James is an incredible, incredible talent, and he was there for all of this journey, and his insights are going to be amazing. I'm so looking forward to this podcast series. It's going to be destination listening, and I think we're all going to learn a whole lot about his experience with Rush, not just on the air and not just on the mic, but certainly all those important times away from it. And I think it's going to be wonderful. So I'm looking forward to it. Let me jump back out on the phones very quickly with Al from Lansing, Michigan. Al, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show. I'm Brett Witterbull.
Hello.
Hello, sir.
Hello.
How are you?
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is that I live in a state where they're literally trying to destroy us. Yeah, I plan on staying here for the rest of my life fighting against their crap.
That's awesome. That's all you now you're in Michigan, which is what? That's a split government, right? Because you have Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, at the top of the top of the government, and then you've got Republicans controlling things in the legislature, correct?
Well, see, well, part of the problem is we have this Attorney General Nessel, and we have this Health and Human Services Department lady. I don't know what her name is, but man, they keep on closing us down. Oh, it's getting worse and worse. No, it's not. All right, I live here. I see it all around. It's not getting worse. They're lying about it. Okay, this is a giant-sized crock. What they're trying to do is keep everybody scared because they don't want anybody to sign a petition against Whitmer to get her recalled or impeached. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're doing. They're trying to keep everybody hidden away so they can't go out and have petitions signed.
Sure. Here's the thing. I respect your desire to stay and fight this fight. You have got a very good shot at fighting that fight in a place like Michigan. That is a place that understands the importance of what the specialness of Michigan is, right? It's a beautiful state. You've got hardworking people, and people want, by and large, have a strong independence streak there. People want to be left to their own devices. And here you come with these directives and dictates coming in from Lansing, telling you how you got to live your life, telling you what you have to do. I think it's a real opportunity for that state to say to Gretchen Whitmer or to say to Attorney General Nussel, no, you're done. You're out. We're going to vote you out. We don't want you in here handing down these dictates. And oh, by the way, are you ever going to get the information on those what do they call them? Confidentiality agreements as people left the jobs there in the health sector to not give up the numbers of people in nursing homes, et cetera.
Just ridiculous. These people need to be held accountable. All right.
This is
Michigan is a great state. We love this state. I grew up here. My wife grew up here. We've actually been all over the country and seen other places. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. We love other places too, but we love Michigan the best.
I respect that.
There's no way we are going to allow some idiot like Gretchen Whitmer to destroy the state that we grew up in and the state where our children live. And I'm sorry, you take a look at what's happened in this state. We literally saved the world during World War II because of the
Amen.
Auto companies. We changed everything over to war machines. We saved the world. And now we're getting stopped for it?
Yeah. The arsenal of democracy. You're 100% right, Al, and I would encourage you to fight for your state. I would encourage you to do the sort of things that require organization, organizing people, getting people committed to try to liberate Michigan. It's not just about people moving around the country to other places, other states, other cities, other communities. There are people that want to stay in a place and they want to fight. You're seeing it take place in California with the attempted recall of Gavin Newsom. That thing is going to the ballot. That's the second time in 20 years you've seen somebody get recalled in the state of California, potentially. And believe you me, he is getting that message loud and clear. Now we have to see what the people are able to pull off. That's a big part of the story. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. And I am Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Let me get Robert in Lively Grove, Illinois, quickly. Robert, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm a resident of Illinois, and this is where we live under a state of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, earlier, you were talking about the population loss.
Yes.
In Illinois. We might lose like 50,000 people a year.
Sure.
But that's the net. You need to remember the people, there's thousands moving in and thousands moving out. The people that move out of the state that I've observed are generally the retired people with the large nest egg,
mm-hmm.
or like my nephews, the ones who have a college education with the potential for a high income.
Right.
The people moving in are generally just high school educated or less,
mm-hmm.
and of the immigrant category.
Right.
Now keep in mind, the people I meet, the high school educated people I meet,
yes, sir.
In church, they are definitely the type of immigrant we want, but still, it's an economic death spiral.
Let me jump in there very quickly because I'm up against it on the clock. The reality is this is not happening in a vacuum. And when we've got a border crisis at the southern border and you've got population shifts happening, well, we'll explain it straight ahead. Another great hour of the Rush Limbaugh Show coming your way. I'm Brett Winterble on the EIB Network. Wonderful to be here. Hour number two now underway, and thrilled to be a part of the conversation with all of you across the Fruited Plain. I am happy to be here. Our phone number, 800-282-2882, 800-282-2882, to have your opinion heard. And I'm thinking about the current culture under which we live, and I know that's a broad encompassing phrase. So let's look at the current iteration of culture under which we live, cancel culture. Do you know that there are people in Hollywood who don't believe that what we're watching play out is actually cancel culture? More on that in just a second. But take a look around at all of the changes that we've seen take place just in the last 4 or 5 years. Setting aside the coronavirus pandemic, look at just the way the culture has trended since, let's say, for argument's sake, just about 2016, 2017. We have seen a full mobilization by activists to drive people from the public stage based upon interviews. Based upon interviews they give or based upon opinions they have. And it's not just that you're to be driven from the stage, you're to be disappeared from the popular culture. Now, I do believe with the incredibly low ratings of the Oscars 2 nights ago that something interesting is manifesting. There's a segment of the population in our country, in our culture, that is just opting out. They're just saying, you know what? Hollywood doesn't respect us. Hollywood doesn't respect me. Hollywood wants to take these positions. Let Hollywood watch Hollywood. I'm out. The idea that the ratings were at, 9.9 million for the Academy Awards, and I understand it was a weird world, the pandemic, all that sort of stuff. But the fact of the matter is people are fleeing. In a free market, people are fleeing and choosing to consume other bits of information and entertainment. But it's not a free market both ways, because if the Hollywood elites, if the big tech oligarchs are able to decide whether or not your point is valid, whether or not you are worthy, whether or not you may proceed to express your opinions, your thoughts, your beliefs, be a part of a debate. If they decide you get to proceed, you get to proceed. If they decide you must go away, well, they will disappear you. It's that simple. LeVar Burton was on The View and was talking about this cancel culture narrative. And he contends that cancel culture is a misnomer, that it's not a cancel culture. He says it's a a consequences culture. It's a culture of consequences. Actor LeVar Burton on Monday on ABC's The View says the term cancel culture is a misnomer. He said that what's happening is consequence culture and that consequences are finally encompassing everybody. Well, it's another way of saying consequences are being delivered by what the clear thinking, analytical folks that get together to judge whether something is good or bad, or is it the mob? A mob of people who just descend either on social media or in real life on somebody's front yard to demand what fix exactly? The First Amendment is the First Amendment. You have a right to your opinions. You have a right to your opinions. But when we're looking now at what cancel culture is creating, because he says it's consequence culture, and he says that systematic racism is alive and well, that it's no cancel culture. It's a consequence culture. And as a result, the systematic racism is alive and well. And so anything goes in terms of battling that narrative. Well, on Sunday morning's Fox News Sunday, Chris Wallace was speaking to Senator Lindsey Graham, asked Senator Lindsey Graham, is there systemic racism in the country, in policing and in other institutions?
This is not in my opinion. We just elected a two-term African-American president. The vice president is of African-American Indian descent. So our systems are not racist. America is not a racist country. So this attack on police and policing, reform the police, yes. Call them all racist, no. You know, America is a work in progress, but best place on the planet, and Joe Biden spends a lot of time running the place down. I wish he'd stop it.
Joe Biden does. The president does oftentimes point to the sins we have experienced and uses those sins and says those sins are apparent and happening in mass today. Yesterday on The View, you had a conversation during a discussion about Senator Lindsey Graham's remarks that he doesn't believe that there is systematic racism in America. And co-host Joy Behar said this.
What's really appalling is Lindsey Graham, who says that there is no systemic racism in this country. I mean, somebody needs to give Lindsey a globe because to tell him which country he's living in. I mean, and is it possible for somebody to get dumber as they get older? I don't remember him being this bad when he was a younger guy. What the heck happened to this guy? First of all, systemic racism is not about tokenism. It is not about the vice president being black or the president being black. It's about what goes on in the lives of everyday people in this country. White privilege needs to be dealt with. These are the things. It has nothing to do with Kamala Harris being a vice president.
What Joy Behar engaged in there was what's called a press. She didn't have a response to Lindsey Graham, so she throws two insults his way. Give him a globe and ask him what country he lives in. That falls flat. It's not a real contention. And then he gets dumber as he gets older. Again, not a response. That's an insult that she would use back in 1936 when she was doing stand-up comedy in New York. The reality is we have to recognize progress that's been made in order to understand what has worked and how we can continue to improve. If you were to say to somebody that that there's absolutely no redemption, no room for improvement, no nothing, what you end up with at that point is you end up with people and eventually a nation going to a place that believes that rehabilitation and redemption is not able to be handled or fixed. Redemption is fundamental to the human experience, that we can strive and do better and improve day after day. Otherwise, we're just not learning anything. Well, back in April of 2016, Rush talked about the time when Joy Behar forgot that she actually agreed with him about America not wanting to watch a woman age as president. Here's how it sounded.
The babes at The View have just discovered what I said maybe 8 years ago about the concept of an aging female president. Remember when at the end of a monologue defending Hillary Clinton, she was under assault for this. I was defending Hillary Clinton. And I asked the question, do the American people want to observe their president, obviously aging. Well, that little question is all that Maud Behar and the babes at The View apparently are aware of what I said. So they think it's outrageous. It's horrible. It's horrible. And so they had a little discussion about it. Here's Joy Behar with her comment on something.
This is from Rush Limbaugh. He says, will Americans want to watch a woman get older before their eyes on a daily basis? That's Rush Limbaugh.
Right. Okay, that's this morning on The View. Let's go back. Same program. December 18th, 2007, Whoopi Goldberg, Baba Wawa, and Joy Behar.
Rush Limbaugh was on the radio, as he always is, and he was commenting on whether we want to watch a woman aging in the White House. He explained he knew that it was going to get into trouble for the comment, but said, I'm talking about the evolution of American culture here, not so much Mrs. Clinton. He also said that presidents age rapidly and added a woman is not going to want to look like she's getting older because it will impact poll numbers. In politics, perceptions are reality, so there will have to be steps taken to avoid the appearance of aging.
He frankly says that a man looks authoritative and a woman does not. That's the difference.
Except that I think that he has a point in that people's looks impact the election.
Oh, wait a minute. Back in 2007, Joy Behar said, but wait, I think he has a point.
It's amazing to watch these hosts on The View always take these positions of outrage, and what they're doing is they're functioning as the prosecutor and the judge and the jury. Rush Limbaugh said that, oh my gosh, it's the worst thing he ever could have said in his life. You're allowed to have opinions, you're allowed to have a discussion, you're allowed to have a debate. Okay, the reason why there is a phrase called a heckler's veto is to protect somebody from being prevented from speaking because it might be unpopular speech. There are cases, as long as your arm, that deal with free speech across the spectrum. And the idea that you can have an opinion that is so dangerous that it must be outlawed, that's anathema to the founding fathers. It's an opinion. It can be countered. It can be matched. It can be proven wrong. That's an important part of what's been lost in our culture by and large. The ability to debate, to make a case, present evidence for an argument, and then to prevail or to lose in that debate and discussion. Everything now descends into simple fighting. And we are better than that. I'm Brent Winterbull, your guide host today on The Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. The magic mask. We're going to talk about the magic mask. Have you seen the new guidelines that are now coming out? Vaccinated Americans do not need masks outdoors in small groups when dining outside or biking and running. This is the new indication from the Centers for Disease Control. I have spent time in small groups. I have dined outside. I have biked and I have run. I'm not wearing a mask when I'm biking or running. I'm not wearing a mask when I'm outdoors in a small group. I'm actually not wearing a mask when I'm outside. Unless, of course, I'm outside in a huge gathering of people who are protesting and being angry. No, I don't understand why this far into the vaccination protocols. What do you got? What was he celebrating a couple days ago? 200 million people have gotten it, or 150 million people have gotten the coronavirus vaccine. Now suddenly the CDC, the very same CDC that 3 weeks ago Dr. Walensky was saying, I'm so worried we're just going to go in reverse. We're all going to crash. It's terrible. We're all doomed. Now comes out and says, hey, if you've had the shot, you can take off your masks outside in small groups when dining outside or biking and running. That's awesome, isn't it? Somebody asked her if we can have a cookout on July 4th. I'm still waiting for the president to give us permission to have a cookout, to cook some hot dogs and hamburgers and brisket and barbecue, chicken and Impossible Burgers. I don't want to alienate anybody. But I didn't know about this directive, so I didn't abide by that directive. I've had the shot, and before I had the shot, I wasn't really abiding by that directive. Masks outside? It's outside. Well, MIT researchers have done some studying, and they found that time spent indoors increases the risk of COVID at 6 feet or 60 feet in a new study challenging social distancing policies. So these numbers are arbitrary. These numbers are arbitrary. And what's becoming increasingly clear is that there's a litmus test going on here. There's a litmus test to see how compliant you'll be with orders from authority. Rush talked about this when he talked about the mask is magic.
So I wanted to warn everybody here that we are on the verge of, we're going to get the Biden COVID vaccine. We're going to get the Biden economic recovery. We're going to get the Biden this and the Biden that. Everything that needs to be fixed, everything that needs to be ramped up, everything needs to be resolved is going to be said by the media to have been resolved by Biden. We're going to be here with a COVID Biden vaccine. We're going to be hearing about the Biden economic recovery. We're going to be hearing about the Biden end to looting and arson. All of this, I just want you to be ready for it. I wanted to get here and have a chance to say this before Biden, but Biden knows the drill more than Republicans do. He knew to beat this program to the punch on that. I know that more and more of you are just tuning media out. And I totally understand, including Fox News, I totally understand that. If there was ever a day, if there was ever a time for devout, exclusive listening to the EIB network, then today it is. And the sum total of the Biden COVID plan is you will wear a mask. You're going to wear a mask, folks. A mask is magic. A mask, said Joe Biden, is not political. No. If we all wear a mask, why, we're going to bring our country together. Oh, yeah. We are going to unify. If everybody just wears the mask, why, we are in Fat City. We're going to fix it all. We're going to fix everything Donald Trump broke. We are going to reunite. We are going to bring the country back together. And in the process of wearing a mask, guess what you're doing? You're giving something back. You notice the left always thinks that you, the people that make the country work, always have something to give back. They never think that the rioters and the looters have anything to give back, though. But you do. Somehow you owe. You owe the country. According to today's Democrat Party and the left, you need to give something back. And so you can do that by wearing a mask. If you would just wear the mask, why, it's magic what would happen. We'd all come together and we'd all make statements that are not political.
The mask. You have to wear the mask. You must wear the mask everywhere you go. You must have the mask on constantly. It must be in your pocket, either front pocket or back pocket. You just put it on your face. You wear it while you're outside. Then you crumple it up. You put it in your pocket. You put it back on as you try to enter a building. You try to enter a store. You wear it while you're in there. Then you take it back off when you get in your car. You crumple it up. You put it in your pocket. The mask, we could use a different word for the mask. We could use a different word for the mask. As Rush was talking about brilliantly there, the idea that you always have to give back more, you have to do more. In sum, let's swap out the word mask for compliance or comply. Compliance is magic. Compliance, said Joe Biden, is not political. No. If we all comply, why, we're going to bring our country together. Oh, yeah. We're going to unify. If everybody just complies, why, we are in Fat City. That's paraphrasing Rush. We're going to fix it all. We're going to fix everything Donald Trump broke. We're going to reunite. All we have to do is comply. This is why people are suspect of the motives of the professional ruling class in Washington, D.C., because we look at them skeptically because they deserve skepticism. Nothing is ever as it appears to be from the professional ruling class, from the Bidens, from the Bushes, from the Kerrys. Oh, we'll talk about him later. Nothing is ever as it seems. It's always you must take this step to prove that you are still on board with the game. Well, what game are you talking about? Whatever the game is today, you must give up your cheeseburgers to show you want to save the planet. Give up your car to show you want to save the planet. Give up your guns to show you're not a gun nut. Give up your liberties. Okay, just comply while you're outside. If you get the shot, then you can non-comply while you're outside, but if you haven't had the shot, you must continue to comply. And if you comply, you get a barbecue on the 4th of July. Wait, I'm going to have a barbecue regardless. You need to comply to get it. We are being governed by people who, by and large, if the institution of government did not exist, they would have to invent the notion of the National Hall Monitor, making notes, taking down notation, filling out forms to talk about your lack of compliance. Because the next stage after compliance is, well, you're complying, but you're not enthusiastically complying. Let me get a harumph out of you. This is why people are suspicious of these blue state regimes, these blue state governors, these blue state power bases, because they've been told to comply for just 14 more days and 14 more days and 14 more days. And almost a year and 3 months later, they still have to sacrifice to prove that they're on board with the program. Plenty more straight ahead. I'm Brett Whittable, your guide host on the EIB Network. I'm looking at this 100-day speech that's coming up tomorrow night, right? It's tomorrow? So it's Wednesday. And President Biden is going to come and address a joint session of Congress that's actually not going to be a joint session of Congress. I mean, in theory, it's going to be a joint session of Congress. But you'll have the president up there on the dais. You'll have Speaker Pelosi behind him and Vice President Harris also behind him. And 200 members of the Congress and the Senate will be in that chamber. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, wait a minute, Brett, that doesn't seem right. There's 435 congressmen, then there's like 100 senators. That's like 535 people. 200 is not 535. Well, you're correct. You're correct. They're going to have a much more sparse turnout. You're going to have social distancing enforced. And the reason I bring this up coming up on 100 days is you have in President Biden, a man who's going to come out and speak and lay out his vision for what's to come in the country. And that's great. We can listen all day long to what he thinks is going to be proposed, right? The Green New Deal for $93 trillion. Beto takes your guns. You name it. The border. Oh, is the border thing still happening? No, the border, all these issues are going to be discussed, and we'll hear these ideas that he's going to lay out. But these people, all of these people, the 200 that are going to be in the chamber or the 535 that could be in the chamber, all of those people have been privileged enough to get the shots. The Speaker, the President, the Vice President, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the other justices of the Supreme Court, the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court. The members of the House, the Senate, the Pentagon. You could do this as a State of the Union, air quotes, type of address and have everybody in there with their shots and masked. But what message does that send to the rest of the world? Where's the sacrifice? Where is the sacrifice at the elite end of government? You don't ever see, they never, ever sacrifice. You're supposed to sacrifice. The strivers have to sacrifice. The workers have to sacrifice. The business owners have to sacrifice. But they don't sacrifice. Their sacrifice is actually, you know, spending their entire time in Washington, working hard to make your country better, because it's not. And that's what they'll tell you. So Biden's first 100 days, we're going to be hearing the different things that he's going to claim, you know, claim credit for: climate change, a summit, the vaccine rollout, the lifting of the mask mandate, promising you maybe you'll get 4th of July to celebrate Independence Day. Well, let's look back at Barack Obama's first 100 days with Rush.
Now, I mentioned the 100 days and the obsession that the drive-bys have. Obama scores high marks, and he does, for how he's handled his job the first 3 months in office, according to new polls released as the 100-day anniversary of his presidency approaches. I mean, all these approval numbers are sky high, through the roof. After the failure to fix the automobile business, after the banks continue to fail, after there's no more credit in the financial system, after everything that they have taken on and they say going to fix, after the stimulus bill, nothing of substance has improved, and yet the approval ratings are through the roof, which has produced, in addition to the fawning stories, I've got four here, two of them from the Washington Post, that are frankly surprising to me, frankly, that they ran these stories. In the Washington Post by Eli Saslow, the headline is 100 Anxious Days. In a South Carolina town where the downturn has deepened since the inauguration, two Obama supporters have struggled, going from fired up to tired out. Listen, I can't read the whole thing to you. I wish I could, but it's six pages. Listen to this. Greenwood, South Carolina, her cordless phone stores 17 voice messages. Tonight, the inbox is full. Edith Childs, 60. Grabs a bottle of water, tosses her hat on the living room floor, scowls at the blinking red light. A county councilwoman, she spent the past 12 hours driving rural roads in her 2001 Toyota Camry, trying to solve Greenwood's problems, but only now begins the part of each day that exhausts her. She slumps into an armless chair and turns on her voicemail. Hi, Ms. Edith, this is Rose. I'm calling about my light bill. It's $420. No way I can pay it. Edith, it's Francine. They stopped by my house again today talking about foreclosure. I don't know what to do. Can you call me? Childs leans back, closes her eyes. Her hair is matted with sweat. Thin-rimmed glasses slink low on her nose. Every few minutes, she stirs to jot notes on a to-do list that fills most of the notebook. This story goes on about economic misery in South Carolina. All these people voted for Obama. None of it's getting fixed.
And let's not forget, that was a combo platter. That was President Obama and Vice President Biden, who was Sheriff Joe, put in charge of the infrastructure plan. Remember the shovel-ready jobs? Or the shovel-your-money-out-the-door jobs? We know what the poll numbers look like because this program yesterday went through those poll numbers and the performance of one President Biden and Vice President Harris. We have a border in crisis. You could do 3 hours on it, just taking calls from people along the border, talking about the disaster we are facing, the very real disaster we're facing there, with no operational plan. And when asked about it, a sitting vice president who is going to tell you, I'm not in charge of the border and I can't go to the border because of COVID, but I am talking to the president of Guatemala because that's more my my jam there. OK, I'm about talking to presidents. I'm not about talking to residents at the border. And so the poll numbers are atrocious for this administration, but for the administration of the vaccine. He has all the levers of power in front of him, and he's been able to roll out that vaccine. And the CDC has been able to go out and to issue guidelines that say you can take a mask off while you're outside if you've had the vaccine. So, in other words, it's all for show. But on the things he's actually done, opening the border, creating the culture at the border for inflows of economic migrants moving into the country who are then spread all around the country, as you heard from that last caller in that last hour in Illinois, the idea that, well, I got all these people coming in and they're just moving them. You know, they're moving in. They're low skilled or they're low income. And I don't know what they're going to be able to do to help continue to grow the economy in Illinois. Well, that's the government is replacing, is taking folks who have moved out of Illinois, and they're redistributing workforces for all intents and purposes that are going to work at a much cheaper rate. I mean, this is kind of the way things are moving about, right? So the president goes and he gives a speech, and he's going to talk about all of his accomplishments. Is he going to talk about John Kerry leaking information to the Iranian foreign minister? Is he going to talk about the fact that not a few weeks ago, our delegation, our highest national security delegation in Alaska was told that our country is horrible and is systemically racist and can't manage its affairs? It's a real challenge in the world today. And on the matters that President Biden has control over in these first 100 days, he's made quite a mess. The polls are the gold standard. That's what the mainstream media tells you. The polls are the gold standard. Polls don't lie. You know what else doesn't? Your bills. Monthly fees for cell phone service are all over the board, one company to another. Pure Talk is a company offering you the same level of cell phone service as one of the big three cell phone companies, but at just $30 a month. Unlimited text, talk, and 6 gigs of data for just $30. Rush discovered Pure Talk last year and suggested you make the switch. And when you make the switch, you keep your cell phone number and your phone. Rush has it all right here.
You shop for the best price you can find on insurance, on home mortgages, on vacation travel, maybe even cheeseburgers. I don't know. So why not do the same thing with cellular phone service? Your cell phone number is your own, and who you choose for cellular service is all up to you. One company makes such a compelling offer, it's worth thinking about. It's Pure Talk. They offer you unlimited talk, text, and 6 gigs of data for just $30 a month. And guess what? If you go over on the data, they don't charge you for it. Pure Talk. Compare that monthly price, $30 a month, to your current cell phone bill, and you'll see why it makes sense to change. Now, I don't know what your cell phone bill is, but I would wager you that it's $60 or more. Maybe $120, maybe $75 or more. This outfit, Pure Talk, is offering you unlimited talk, unlimited text, and 6 gigs of data for $30 a month. Now, Pure Talk knows they're in the same business with the likes of AT&T and Verizon and T-Mobile. In fact, get this, they use the same cell towers of one of the big companies that covers 99% of the country. They offer superior service. 100% of the Pure Talk customer support team is right here in America. So you make one phone call to them today, you can start to save money by switching to Pure Talk. All you do is get your cell phone and dial #250. Next, you say Pure Talk. It's that simple. You'll save 50% off your first month. That's #250 and then say Pure Talk. One of the Pure Talk customer service people will be right there on the phone to help you. And by the way, it's legit, $30 a month, unlimited talk, text, and 6 gigs of data.
I'm Brett Winterbull. You're listening to The Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. And I'm Brett Winterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. You know, if you're a podcast listener, you're going to want to subscribe and listen to a new podcast created in honor of Rush. It's hosted by none other than our own James Golden. Here's the voice that will help remind you of the greatness of our beloved Rush, James Golden himself.
Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the Golden EIB microphone. It's a new podcast hosted by yours truly, James Golden, or, as many of you know me, Bo Snerdly. I'm going to take you behind the scenes for an intimate look at the man, Rush Limbaugh, who changed America as we know it. It's coming May 12th to iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast, presented by MyPillow and the Tunnel to Towers Foundation.
Destination listening. Greg in Augusta, Georgia. Welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show.
Hey, Brett. One of the things I just heard, one of the clips from Rush, talked about how people then don't need to come down from the north to the south and, you know, bring their baggage with them. And I equate that to like the old days when people assimilated into the United States or came over and came into the United States to enjoy our country. They assimilated themselves into our culture. So, yeah, they brought some of their old world stuff with them.
Sure.
But they, you know, learned how to speak English and they became an American. That's what you come to America for. Same thing with the folks coming from the north now. They're coming down here bringing their baggage, and they wanted to, you know, have a nice life. But they're bringing the same old thing. They're bringing their democratic policies. And so what happens is, like, Stacey Abrams moving down here from the north, wherever she came from, I think Minnesota or Michigan or something. trying to turn our state blue, you know, it's not going to work. It's, you know, you get the same answer, you know, and well, so they'll turn us in the conservative area, trying to turn us into a, you know, a Democratic stronghold.
So let me say this, Greg, and you're in a beautiful part of Georgia. I envy you living in Augusta. Let me say this, and I appreciate your call. Let me spin it forward this way. It's not just about hoping that folks don't bring, say, socialist inclinations or big government inclinations or union control of state institutions, all that sort of stuff. It's not about that. What has to be done in these places that you have people migrating to is the folks that are there have to also sell them on the benefits of being more conservative fiscally, financially, from a perspective of government. Because we know that if you let the camel's nose under the tent, it is potentially devastating when it comes to any number of things. And so I believe that in the places where people are moving into, the folks who have been there longer term, maybe all their lives, have a responsibility to evangelize the people that are moving in into the values of limited government, smaller government, lower taxes, greater opportunity. Many people who move to these places may not know any better. They may have just been conditioned their whole life to think that I'm supposed to pay heavy duty property taxes. I'm supposed to pay heavy duty income taxes. And they've now made a decision to leave. They've decided to pull up stakes and go to greener pastures, not just because the houses are cheaper, not just because the schools are better, but because they're wanting to affiliate with that new reality. So when you talk about the assimilation of an immigrant coming into America, that's true. The immigrant should want to assimilate, but it's also up to those people in the community to help those new Georgians, those new Carolinians, those new Tennesseans, those new Alabamans to assimilate and to become a part of what has made that part of the country so successful. The same with the Intermountain West. Many people in Montana will tell you how badly the people of California have come in and messed that up with their weird watering restrictions and different sorts of regulations that they want to see put into effect. Respect where it is you're moving, learn as much as you can about it, and figure out that common ground that unites us all in freedom. Plenty more straight ahead. I'm Brett Winterble. It's the Rush Limbaugh Show on the EIB Network. Brett Winterble in as your guide host this week on the EIB Network. All right, coming up in this next hour, I have been wanting to talk about this all day long. John Kerry caught up in doing the sort of thing you'd expect John Kerry to do. You just would. This guy has been a thorn in the side of so many Americans for so long. Is it his self-entitlement? Yes. Is it his self-importance? You betcha. Is it his desire to be beloved on the world stage? Well, it appears he may have gone too far. I know it's hard to believe that he went too far. He may have gone far too far by leaking information to a country that on a regular basis declares they want to wipe out the great Satan, us, and the little Satan, Israel. This is a guy that John Kerry is friends with, who's from the regime that declares kill the great Satan and kill the little Satan. And John Kerry gave this guy apparently secret information, but it's worse and worse and worse as time goes on here, as we start to look at what it is that's at play. This is a disaster if you are any kind of a person who respects the rule of law and norms. Brett Winterble on the EIB Network. A pleasure to be here at this great opportunity and this great time in the greatest country in the world. I am Brett Winterble. The New York Times has uncovered what is a bombshell, but they buried it when it comes to John Kerry. The New York Times taking criticism today for burying a report that former Secretary of State John Kerry told Iran that Israel had attacked Iranian interests in Syria at least 200 times. The story focuses on the leaked audio of the Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif speaking candidly about the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, a powerful branch of Iran's armed forces and a U.S.-designated terrorist organization. However, 21 paragraphs into a 26-paragraph story, the Times drops a major revelation. Former Secretary of State John Kerry and Democrat nominee for president in 2004 and Secretary of State after that informed him that Israel had attacked Iranian interests in Syria at least 200 times. And that was to Zarif's astonishment. He was shocked he was getting this information from John Kerry. Sure, they were buddies. They were tight. They were friends. The Times reporter Farnaz Fasihi wrote, Secretary of State from 2013 to 2017, where he was instrumental in brokering the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. Deal was heavily opposed by Israel, with whom John Kerry has frequently sparred. But think about this guy. This guy was a Secretary of State. He's now in the inner circle of the Biden administration as the climate czar, the guy who goes around asking and begging for concessions and forgiveness for the United States for climate crimes that we've committed, right? This is a man who for, well, basically all of his adult life has been wrong on every foreign policy decision that he's ever faced. Well, no, are you talking about Joe Biden, Brett? No, I'm talking about John Kerry. Joe Biden was also accused of that by Bob Gates in a Wall Street Journal op-ed. So here you have the Iranian government. Zarif is a senior player. He's a guy who may have wanted to run for the presidency of Iran. He's a guy who is BFFs with John Kerry. I mean, he's friends with John Kerry. He's friends with Valerie Jarrett, who's on the inside of the Obama team. This is a guy who travels the world and comes off as this reasoned face of diplomacy. And the reality is he's tied right back to all of the regime leaders there in Tehran. So here's Zarif having this interview over a number of hours with an Iranian journalist, and he's just spilling all the beans. He said, yeah, I never liked that Soleimani guy. Yeah, the mullahs won't let me do what I have to do in terms of running foreign policy. Yeah, Soleimani was a bad guy who was always trying to make me go extract concessions from the Russians. I don't like the Russians either. I've got concerns about this. I've got concerns about that. And, oh, by the way, John Kerry told me that the Iranians were attacked 200 times by the Israelis in Syria. Rush knew full well what John Kerry was up to, that John Kerry was working with the Iranians to undermine America.
There was a dinner party in Washington last night. I was not there, of course, but I got feedback from it. And here is the bottom line of what was revealed. John Kerry, former Secretary of State for Barack Hussein O, has been talking to the Iranians and has been telling them to hold the line, to wait out Donald Trump and his administration. Don't make a deal with Trump, Kerry is telling the Iranians. In fact, the exact words, don't make a bad deal with Trump, meaning any deal that you make with Trump is going to be bad for you, the Iranians, and Kerry is telling them not to do it. Wait until Trump is beaten in 2020 and do a deal with a Democrat. Supposedly, Kerry has met with the Iranians four times since leaving his office at the State Department, and these words were said. Now, two things. How is that different than Michael Flynn talking to the Russians before being National Security Advisor? How's that any different? Michael Flynn talking to the Russian ambassador as the incoming NSA, and now he's charged with lying to the FBI. His family is ruined. He's ruined financially. Here's Kerry talking to the Iranians. I know what many of you are shouting at your radio. Ted Kennedy did. Yes, he did. during the Reagan administration, Ted Kennedy was sending letters to Yuri Andropov and whatever Soviet leader. They kept dying. Why Reagan didn't talk to him, because they kept dying. But Ted Kennedy was sending letters to Soviet leaders saying, don't deal with Reagan. Wait him out. We'll eventually get the White House back. We'll get rid of Reagan. He'll be gone someday. Deal with us. This is sabotage. Kerry's a saboteur. This is undermining the will of the American people. John Kerry's never been elected to anything other than the United States Senate. He's not been elected to do what he's doing now. How is John Kerry not breaking the law? He's not in the United States government telling the Iranians not to do a deal with Trump. Anybody say Logan Act? Michael Flynn threatened with jail time?
Logan Act. That's exactly what Michael Flynn was facing. The Logan Act. And he was brought in on phony charges underneath that theory by a corrupted FBI with James Comey and, of course, McCabe. So let's unpack this for a moment, because what is the upside for John Kerry giving advice to the Iranian foreign minister? What's the upside for John Kerry personally? This is a man who is consistently wrong on issues. We could pick a few of them out. We can go back to the Iraq War in 2003. John Kerry voted to authorize the Iraq War. In 2003, he voted against continued funding and the aid necessary to secure victory. The flip-flop was not only indefensible, it cost him the 2004 election against George W. Bush. In the Gulf War in 1991, not only did Senator Kerry vote against authorizing UN-approved action against Saddam Hussein, he also argued for a, quote, new world order, not led by the U.S., and criticized the American-led coalition of President George H.W. Bush that he had built. In 2007, John Kerry voted against a Senate resolution that wanted to combat, contain, and roll back the violent activities of the destabilizing influence inside the Islamic Republic of Iran that were carrying out those attacks in Iraq. In 2003, CBS News reported John Kerry called Israel's anti-terror security barrier, which saved hundreds of Israeli and Palestinian lives, a barrier to peace. In Syria, 2009, John Kerry condemned Syria as a supporter of terrorism in 1991 when Syria aligned with the U.S. in the Gulf War. He later embraced dictator Assad, leading Democrats' efforts to rehabilitate Assad's murderous regime. And you go back to 1971, the Winter Soldier investigation. Senator John Kerry's record has nothing compared to what happened back then. The Winter Soldier investigation as a decorated veteran telling false stories about war crimes allegedly committed by American troops in Vietnam. This is also a man who, don't forget, in the wake of the shocking attacks by ISIS in Paris in 2015, the Charlie Hebdo attack by the ISIS attackers there in France, brought with him as a means of trying to calm the nerves of the French people who were under siege by this resurgent terrorist group in ISIS, he brought James Taylor to sing You've Got a Friend. He literally did that. And at the end of his tenure, don't forget what John Kerry did. John Kerry apologized to the Iranian regime who had taken our sailors hostages and forced them to bow down on their knees and to apologize for incursions into Iranian waters. And John Kerry said, this is really great that you've helped us get our people back. You are phenomenal. This is wonderful. We thank the government of Iran. Of course, because Zarif is his friend. And so now you've got this guy freelancing on foreign policy. He's not going in front of the Senate committees or the House committees to talk about his foreign policy efforts. He ought to have his security clearance stripped, just stripped. He shouldn't be getting access to intelligence because he's apparently sending that intelligence to the Iranian regime. And oh, isn't it rich in one bright spot of irony? Isn't it rich that when you listen to these recordings, you find out that it turns out, while the regime was all up in arms about the death of Soleimani, thinking that the Soleimani killing was a horrible thing, Zarif actually couldn't stand Soleimani and didn't seem to be bummed out about Soleimani being taken down by Donald Trump. So that actually puts Joe Biden still on the side of the Iranian mullahs, because Joe Biden said it was tragic and a mistake to go and take out Soleimani, the biggest terrorist that Iran ever produced. I told you, John Kerry's been wrong for decades. Almost as wrong as President Biden. And these are the guys trying to cobble back together the Iranian nuclear deal that we know they're going to violate. Curious. 800-282-2882. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. I am Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. You missing Rush when the show ends each day? Well, Rush is there for you any time of the day or night at Rush 24/7. Find out what Rush said on any topic, listen to entire shows, or watch him on the Ditto Cam through the vast audio and video archives available exclusively to Rush 24/7 members by using the easy search function on the site. Join at rushlimbaugh.com, choose a monthly subscription, or lock in a full year. Rush is always there for you at Rush 24/7. A lot of talk about the supermoon. Everybody's talking about the supermoon, the pink moon, the supermoon, all that stuff that people have been looking at and trying to digest. Rush had thoughts on the supermoon. Here's what he said.
You ever heard of a supermoon? You know what it is? Supermoon is when the moon is closest to the Earth that it's almost ever been. In this case, closest in 60 years. Oh, yeah, the tides are going to flood marinas. Might get earthquakes, moonquakes, who knows? March 19th, Earth's moon will be at its closest point, at 18 years here. And the event was dubbed a supermoon by astrologer Richard Knoll back in the 1970s. And all possible, all kinds of things, tidal surges, magnitude 5 or other higher earthquakes, even volcanic activity is possible because of the supermoon. Well, we survived it 18 years ago, and I dare say most people never even knew what was going on 18 years ago. But this guy Richard Knoll is out there warning everybody now that it could be disastrous out there. If it were hurricane season, I don't know, we might not survive. That's how they do it. Everything's crisis. From what you eat to where you go to where you drive to what you wear when you drive to, it doesn't matter what it is. I just got an email from somebody, a real Linda, thanking me for telling them what a supermoon is. They thought, this person, a real Linda, thought a supermoon was when a fat guy dropped trowel. And they've often wondered what it had to do. They've been hearing about the supermoon in 2 days, and they wanted to know where the guy was going to be. So they feel properly informed now.
Oh, that's awesome. That's the best. Let's go out on the phones, talk to Dan in West Columbia, South Carolina, on the Rush Limbaugh Show. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Brett. Thanks for taking my call today. First, let me say God bless you and all the talented people you work with who continue to fan the flames of freedom that Rush ignited so many years ago.
Thank you, sir, for that. That was very kind.
I have been following closely the results of the survey. What am I trying to say?
Oh, the census. So you're looking at the census numbers.
Yes, sir. I'm so delighted to see what's going on. Unfortunately, South Carolina is not a state that is going to get an additional representative.
Right.
However, I've got a deal. In the true sense of Southern hospitality, I would like to welcome a New Yorker to South Carolina in exchange for our resident socialist-in-chief, Jim Clyburn. Your producer told me I'd probably have to offer boot, like some shrimp from Charleston, maybe some peaches from Lexington County. But we're willing to do that. When they come in season, they're all yours. Just all you got to do is take Clyburn off our hands.
that's an interesting trade. I don't know if they're going to do it. That is a very interesting.
We're never going to take her.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. It's going to be, but well considered, Dan. And you were so considerate to celebrate the great team here at the EIB Network, continuing to push for the freedom and the liberty that Rush so deeply believed in. Thank you so much for calling, and don't be a stranger. Call us back again. We'd love to hear from you. I always wonder, you know, you have these foreign exchange programs. You know, you do have these foreign exchange programs where you have a student from Sweden and they come and live with you for the summer, and you send a student over to to Cairo to study for the summer, whatever it's going to be. You know, we could do this with red states. We could begin to build a process of understanding and conviviality with people from blue states. You bring their children in and expose to them the freedom and the liberty that exists here, and they'll go home and they'll be wanting freedom and liberty the minute they get out of high school. It's got to be possible to work, right? Edna in Jupiter, Florida is up next. Edna, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm wondering why in all of this business about John Kerry that nobody ever mentions the fact that his daughter, Vanessa, is married to an Iranian national and physician. And the best man at the ceremony was the son of Mohammad Javad Zarif, who is Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs.
Yeah, you know,
why does nobody ever talk about that?
I think probably the average person walking around doesn't know it, but you are right. He was trained at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's a neurosurgeon, and his name is Dr. Brian Behrouz Nahred. They were married in 2009. It doesn't ever come up. I think it just doesn't come up in the confirmation hearings because, well, if you figure when John Kerry was up for consideration, I mean, basically, the Republicans waved him through. I mean, it was a universally waved through thing for Secretary of State. And the reality is there's so much other real estate you could be going after with Kerry just based on his own track record before you even get into familial relationships. But look, this is a cozy thing that exists out there in the world, right? Washington, D.C. and the international stage. These people go through these revolving doors constantly, and they have relationships and marriages and dating situations and what have you. It would be wonderful if somebody could endeavor to make a book that kind of drew together all the lines of who's connected to who. Oh, that news anchor on that network is connected to this person. Remember, for a very long time, in fact, I'm right to remember this, for a very long time, people ignored the fact that David Rhodes was running CBS News. He was the CBS News president. And Ben Rhodes was in the White House feeding talking points, dictating talking points to the Beltway press to sell the Iranian nuclear deal. In fact, Ben Rhodes was so derisive. He was so derisive of the Beltway press, these 25 and 30 year old reporters for MSNBC and CNN and all the magazines, that he actually said he couldn't believe how much he had to actually lay the stories out for them because they didn't understand basic geopolitical realities. But you're right. A great point, Edna. John Kerry's daughter is married to a neurosurgeon who has of Iranian extraction, Persian extraction. So, I mean, this is the way of Washington. We have got to get you. My gosh, Hunter Biden's got really good friends in China. Maybe the president does, too. I'm just saying. Another great half hour straight ahead. I'm Brett Winterble here on the EIB Network. And our phone number to be a part of the conversation, 800-282-2882. But you all know that number. You've got it memorized. I like to remind you every once in a while. It's been said many, many times, and Rush said this specifically, that this presidency for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris is Obama's third term. Well, if that's the case, we got scandals aplenty brewing. Do you remember the last time the Obama regime got into bed with the IRS? I remember it like it was yesterday.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, a random act journalism from the Washington Post, of all places. The Washington Post has found that the IRS's scrutiny of conservative groups was not contained among low-level workers in the Cincinnati office. Now, the Cincinnati office, by the way, I have since learned the Cincinnati office is exclusive to tax-exempt status and tax-exempt organizations. It's not some insignificant little satellite office off the beaten path that handles a few things here and a few things there. This is the place where every application for tax-exempt status goes through. And so Obama and the administration said, well, it's just a bunch of low-level rogue people that they're acting on their own pretty much in Cincinnati. However, the Washington Post today, Internal Revenue Service officials in Washington and at least two other offices were involved with investigating conservative groups seeking tax-exempt status, making clear that the effort reached well beyond the branch in Cincinnati that was initially blamed. And the Washington Post says this is according to documents that they have seen. IRS officials at the agency's Washington headquarters sent queries to conservative groups asking about their donors and other aspects of their operations, while officials in the El Monte and Laguna Niguel offices in California sent similar questionnaires to Tea Party-affiliated groups. So some of the scrutiny came from IRS headquarters. What a shock! What an absolute... Who would have believed this? Now, IRS employees in Cincinnati told conservatives seeking the status of social welfare groups that a task force in Washington was overseeing their applications, according to interviews with the activists. In other words, even the low-level workers in Cincinnati were being told what to do by a task force in Washington. So this whole story that it was a bunch of low-level people in Cincinnati that were acting pretty much on their own, totally blown up now by the Washington Post. Lois Lerner, who oversees tax-exempt groups of the IRS, did you hear what she said shortly after this story broke? Well, I'm not very good at math. Well, that's helpful. A chief officer of the Internal Revenue Service admitting, I'm not very good with math. Lois Lerner told reporters last Friday that the absolutely inappropriate actions were undertaken by frontline people working in Cincinnati to target groups with Tea Party, Patriot, or 912 in their names, all of which we now know was a series of lies. These actions were not done by frontline or low-level people, and not just in Cincinnati. And they were not just targeting names, but anything that indicated they were conservative. And Ms. Lerner also lied about when she found out about this. She actually learned about this in June of 2011. Now, you try lying to the IRS, see what happens to you. Now, in one instance, Ron Bell, an IRS employee, informed a lawyer representing a conservative group focused on voter fraud that the application was under review in Washington. On several other occasions, IRS officials in Washington and California sent conservative groups detailed questionnaires about their voter outreach and other activities, according to the documents. Cleta Mitchell, partner in the law firm of Foley and Lardner, who sought to communicate with IRS headquarters about the delay in granting tax-exempt status to something called True the Vote, said for the IRS to say it was some low-level group in Cincinnati is simply false. So we know now that the woman in charge of this division at the IRS did not tell the truth on practically every single point. Actions were not done by frontline or low-level people, not just in Cincinnati. Lois Lerner also lied about when she found out about this scrutiny. She actually learned about it in June of 2011. We also now know, thanks to the Washington Post story, the IRS was even lying to senators and congressmen who wrote to them to ask about the tax-exempt applications of conservative groups. And we also know now that the IRS was not just targeting keywords in the group's names. They were targeting anything that indicated they were conservative. In fact, the Washington Post even points out, quote, although some of the groups were explicitly labeled Tea Party or Patriot, others that came under intense scrutiny were focused on challenging the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, or the integrity of federal elections. You know, what's kind of disturbing here, folks, since the IRS is going to be the enforcement agency of Obamacare. Andrea Mitchell, NBC News, Washington, said the fact that they went after the Tea Party here feeds the Republican critics. And this is one of the most outrageous excesses I have seen in all of my years in journalism. Andrea Mitchell, NBC News, Washington, calling this one of the most outrageous excesses that she has ever seen in all of her years of journalism. This one is easily understandable. The IRS targeting people suspect this anyway. Now this is confirmation of it.
And now moving forward, We know that Joe Biden wants to send another $80 billion to the IRS for enforcement operations, $80 billion to crack down on tax evasion by high earners with questionable setups and those sorts of things, which, OK, is fine. That's like understandable IRS type business. But the idea that you're going to go to these organizations and demand their reading lists, demand transcripts of speeches that activists gave, membership lists, addresses, all that sort of stuff, that is well beyond the pale. And that's what the IRS did. And don't forget, you've got an administration in Washington right now headed up by Joe Biden, who was vice president of the United States when Lois Lerner and the IRS were running amok. It's incredible the way you will see American citizens targeted by the use of these enforcement agencies, the IRS, unmasking Trump campaign officials, crooked people in the FBI doing investigations that they know they don't have evidence. I mean, this is all just madness. Don't forget, Joe Biden wants to have usage fees and ownership fees on firearms. That's part of the contention, right? He wants to, what do you want, a $200 fee or a $1,000 fee on an AR-15? Who do you think is going to be responsible for collecting those fees? The Infernal Revenue Service. It's going to be the way it's going to be. Jerry is in Central Ohio. Hello, Jerry. Welcome to the program.
It's Cherry.
Cherry, welcome to the show.
That's okay. I'm just calling because this kind of thing has been going on for a long time. Mm-hmm. As I sat on hold, I realized I probably shared the details a little bit incorrectly with the call screener. But back in the Carter administration, I was involved with a local Right to Life group. We were CK 501c3. We actually did get that status, but we could not get a bulk mailing permit from the mm-hmm. post office mm-hmm. because Carter had stopped them all for any pro-life organization. You could not get it. As soon as the administration changed, as soon as Reagan was elected, we got our bulk mailing permit. I mean, they have used these agencies for a long time. Yep. I don't think we have any idea what the extent of it is.
It's a great point. It's a great point because you're talking about an abuse of the system at a systemic level. You're talking about a systemic problem. The use of the IRS to chill speech and to chill opposition. That is 100% wrong. And as Rush alludes to in the beginning of that clip, this is the agency that was tasked with enforcement of Obamacare. Did you get your health insurance? Did you buy the Obamacare? Here is the fine you must pay for not buying the Obamacare. Meanwhile, they're monitoring everything that you're reading and who you're talking about what with. I'm Brett Witterbull, your guide host today on the EIB Network. As you well know, there's enough negative news in the world that we wanted to end every program on a high note and with good vibes. As Rush would say, we're calling it our EIB High Note. And today's High Note is about Leah and her Labrador, Brea. So you got Leah and Brea. The two work together, bringing comfort to kids in the hospital dealing with serious health issues. This is something that Leah herself can personally relate to, having been diagnosed with cerebral palsy as a child. Part of her therapy involved working with animals, which was a game changer for her outlook and removed some of the fear. Her lab, Brea, was trained by Canine Companions for Independence, and now they accompany kids in the hospital to scary appointments when they need to get an IV, an MRI, or even a CAT scan. Leah explains it this way.
Just being a dog in a hospital sometimes changes the whole vantage point of what they're thinking about. Because it was just the culmination of all the things that I felt was the best medicine for kids.
It's absolutely an incredible effort that's being made there because it's tense enough when you're an adult going in for a treatment or going in for a test. Being a child and having to go in, especially if it's on an ongoing basis or a regular basis, is certainly got to be frightening and make you feel upset. And the fact that Leah is doing this with her Labrador, Brea, is phenomenal. It is phenomenal. You're putting those children at ease. One thing I'm also incredibly excited about is this. And you being able to listen to this new forthcoming podcast about this program and our Rush Limbaugh. The podcast debuts in just 2 weeks' time. It's called Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone. Here's the host of it, James Golden, with a brief introduction on what you're in for.
Rush Limbaugh, the man behind the golden EIB microphone. A new podcast hosted by yours truly, James Golden, or as many of you know me, Bo Snerdly. Come with me behind the scenes for an exciting and intimate look at the man who changed America as we know it. Coming Wednesday, May 12th to iHeartRadio or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Presented by the Tunnel to Towers Foundation and MyPillow.
I'll be there and I hope you are as well. We know John is in Hudson, Ohio. John, welcome to the Rush Limbaugh Show.
How you doing today?
Doing well. Thank you for calling, sir.
The reason why I'm calling is a while back, Rush alluded that some of that $1.6 billion may have ended up in the pockets of Kerry and Obama, and that we should be following the money and find out what happened with that $1.6 billion in cash.
Well, the tricky thing about $1.6 billion in cash is that magic word, cash. Right? Because cash can disappear. And we remember when the pallets of cash were sent over to the mullahs as part of the Iranian nuclear deal, the sweetener for the nuclear deal. We know that it was sent over not just in dollars, but in other foreign currency instruments and denominations. The question is, where did that money go? And who got that money? It's going to be a story that we're going to have to track and trace. I'll see what I can do to dig it up for more information in coming days. But the reality is, I find myself wondering, if, as John Kerry is advising Zarif, what is the relationship there? Are these just two BFFs, or is there some business interest involving these two? Does Zarif make more money if Iran is back in the international markets and is a member of the international community? And of what benefit is that then for John Kerry? Because John Kerry is a guy who's got to make money, doesn't have any kind of a full-time job. He's the climate czar. And I know we married into a lot of money, but still, you need income coming in. So that's a very interesting question. It's something that we'll try to run down. And I do appreciate the question about that today, John in Hudson, Ohio. Let's go to Amy in Hilton Head, South Carolina next. Amy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brett, how you doing?
Doing great, thank you.
Good. So my first shout out is WBT in Charlotte. I was there for over 20 years, and it was the best station ever. And I just am proud and excited that you're on our Rush Limbaugh show.
Oh, well, thank you.
I also wanted to tell you that I got through to Rush last year, and it was like the greatest day of my life. I was so excited. My husband heard me. My dad heard me. It was just a really great thing, and I'm so glad I had gotten through finally before he parted ways. And I just wanted to also mention that the moms down here in the Hilton Head, Bluffton, mm-hmm. South Carolina area are getting rallied up. The lady from Georgia really inspired everybody for the no masks on our kids mandate. And just want to do a shout out to them. And if people are looking or interested, there's a South Carolina, no mask for our kids stuff out there, so everybody get on board and help them out, because they're not getting very far with the town councils and stuff. They're not giving them very much time. So,
well, that and this is the challenge. And thank you for the call, Amy, and the very kind words about the station. And I'm so happy you were able to get on with Rush. I know it meant so much to him to talk to as many of the people out there in this audience who meant so much to him throughout his entire career. It was immeasurable. What the callers meant to him, and I can attest to that personally. Look, we never know where that spark is going to go that's going to begin a call for change. And that's what's different about the left and the right. The left is a top-down operation. The right is much more organic, and you have people taking stands, and they attract more and more people to be a part of what that is. And it's important to understand that. Great call, Amy. Great to talk to you. I'm Brett Winterble, your guide host today on the EIB Network. A quick note on the way out this afternoon. I want you to start thinking about this Biden speech that's going to happen with that joint address to the Congress. We know that the president is going to credit government and governors and vice presidents and speakers of the House and Chuck Schumer's and Nancy Pelosi, all those people. He's going to credit all of that for the great success he's had in his first 100 days. Will he specifically credit the pharmaceutical companies, you know, those evil companies who had a big hand in developing the vaccines? I know there was government money involved, but it was these institutions that delivered the goods. I'm Brett Winterbull. I'll be back again tomorrow on the EIB Network.